cruel fate instead. Ruskin's flashy green Saab turbo picked me up in front of the Washington Duke Inn. He and Davy Sykes are trying to be more cooperative lately. Sykes was taking a day off, his first in a month, according to his detective partner. Ruskin actually seemed glad to see me. He hopped out of the car in front of the hotel and pumped my hand as if we were friends. As always, Ruskin was dressed for success. Black Armani rip-off sport coat, black pocket T-shirt. Things were picking up a little for me in the New South. I got the feeling that Ruskin knew I had connections with the FBI, and that he wanted to use them, too. Detective Nick Ruskin was definitely a mover and shaker. This was a career-making case for him. "Our first big break," Ruskin said to me. "What do you know about the intern so far?" I asked en route to the University of North Carolina Hospital. "She's hanging in there. Apparently she came down the Waikiki like a slippery fish. They're saying it's a miracle. Not even a major broken bone. But she's in shock, or something worse. She can't talk, or she won't talk. The docs are using words like catatonic and post-traumatic shock. Who knows at this point? At least she's alive." Ruskin had a lot of enthusiasm, and he could also be charismatic. He definitely wanted to use my connections. Maybe I could use his. "Nobody knows how she got into the river, or how she got away from him," Ruskin told me as we entered the college town of Chapel Hill. The thought of Casanova stalking female students here was terrifying. The town was so pretty and seemed so vulnerable. "Or whether she actually was with Casanova," I added a thought. "We don't know that for sure." "We don't know shit from Shinola, do we?" Nick Ruskin complained, as he turned down a side street marked hospital. "I'll tell you one thing, though. This story is about to go public in a big way. The circus just came to town. See, up ahead?" Ruskin had that right. The scene outside North Carolina University Hospital was already a media bedlam. Television and press reporters were camped out in the parking lot, the front lobby, and all over the serene, sloping green lawns of the university. Photographers snapped my picture, as well as Nick Ruskin's, when we arrived. Ruskin was still the local star detective. People seemed to like him. I was becoming a minor celebrity, at least a curiosity in the case. My involvement in the Gary Sonogy kidnapping had already been broadcast by the local WAGs. I was Dr. Detective Cross, an expert on human monsters from up north. "Tell us what's going on," a woman reporter called out. "Give us a break, Nick. What's the real story with Kate McTiernan?"
"If we're lucky, maybe she can tell us."
Ruskin smiled at the reporter, but he kept on walking until we were safely inside the hospital. Ruskin and I were far from first in line, but we were allowed to see the intern later that night. Kyle Craig pulled the necessary strings for me. A determination had been made that Katalia McTiernan wasn't psychotic, but that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. It seemed a reasonable diagnosis. There was absolutely nothing that I could do that night. Anyway, I stayed after Nick Ruskin left, and I read all the medical charts, the nursing notes, and write-ups. I perused the local police reports describing how she had been found by 2 12-year-old boys who had skipped school to fish and smoke cigarettes down by the riverside. I suspected I knew why Nick Ruskin had called me, too. Ruskin was smart. He understood that Kate McTiernan's current state might involve me in the case as a psychologist, especially since I had dealt with this kind of post-stress trauma before. Katalia McTiernan, survivor, but just barely. I stood beside her bed for a full 30 minutes that first night. Her IV was hooked up to a drip monitor. The bed's side rails were up high and tight around her. There were already flowers in the room. I remembered a sad, powerful Sylvia Plath poem called Tulips. It was about Plath's decidedly unsentimental reaction to flowers sent to her hospital room after a suicide attempt. I tried to recall what Kate McTiernan had looked like before she got the black eyes. I'd seen the photos. A lot of ugly swelling made her face look as if she were wearing goggles or a gas mask. There was more nasty swelling surrounding her jaw. According to the hospital write-up, she'd lost a tooth, too. Apparently it had been knocked out at least 2 days before she was found in the river. He'd beaten her, Casanova, the self-proclaimed lover. I felt bad for the young intern. I wanted to tell her it would be all right somehow. I rested my hand lightly on hers and repeated the same sentences over and over. "You're among friends now, Kate. You're in a hospital in Chapel Hill. You're safe now, Kate." I didn't know if the badly injured woman could hear me or even understand me. I just wanted to say something consoling to her before I left for the night. And as I stood there watching the young woman, the image of Naomi's face flashed before me. I couldn't imagine her dead. "Is Naomi all right, Kate McTiernan? Have you seen Naomi Cross?" I wanted to ask, but she couldn't have answered anyway. "You're safe now, Kate. Sleep easy, sleep well. You're safe now." Kate McTiernan couldn't say a word about what had happened. She had lived through a horrifying nightmare that was worse than anything I could imagine. She had seen Casanova, and he had left her speechless. Chapter 47
Tick-tock.
A young lawyer named Chris Chapin had brought home a bottle of Chardonnay de Beaulieu, and he and his fiancée, Anna Miller, were drinking the California wine in bed. It was finally the weekend. Life was good again for Chris and Anna. "Thank God this god-awful work week is over," sandy-haired 24-year-old Chris exclaimed. He was an associate at a prestigious law office in Raleigh. Not exactly Mitch McDear in the firm, no German-made convertible to sign on, but a good start on his lawyering career.
"Unfortunately, I have a paper on contracts due Monday," Anna grimaced. She was in her third year of law school. "Plus, it's for the sadist Stacklum."
"Not tonight, Anna Banana. Screw Stacklum. Better still, screw me."
"Thank you for bringing home the vino." Anna finally smiled. Her white teeth were dazzling.
Chris and Anna were good for each other. Everyone said so, all their lawyer pals. They complimented each other, had pretty much the same world view, and, most of all, were smart enough not to try to change each other. Chris was obsessive about his job. Okay, fine. Anna needed to go antiquing at least twice a month. She spent her own money as if there were no tomorrow. That was okay, too.
"I think this wine needs to breathe a little while longer," Anna said with an impish grin.
While we're waiting..."
She slipped down the straps of a white lace demi-bra. She'd purchased the bra and matching lace strip at Victoria's Secret in the mall.
"Yep. Thank God it's the weekend," said Chris Chapin.
The two of them fell into an all-purpose embrace, playfully undressing each other, kissing, caressing, losing themselves in the sexy moment. In the middle of their lovemaking, Anna Miller had a strange feeling. She sensed that someone else was in the bedroom. She pulled away from Chris. Someone was standing at the foot of the bed. He was wearing a grimly painted mask. Red and yellow dragons, fierce ones, angry and grotesque figures that appeared to be clawing at one another.
"Who the hell are you? What are you?"
Chris said in a frightened voice. He searched for the ball bat they kept under the bed and found the bat handle.
"Hey, I asked you a fucking question!"
The intruder growled like a wild animal.
"Well, here's a fucking answer."
Casanova's right arm came up holding a Luger. He fired once, and a large red hole opened in Chris Chapin's forehead. The young lawyer's naked body slammed back against the bed's headboard. The ball bat in his hand dropped to the floor. Casanova moved quickly. He whipped out a second gun and shot Anna in the chest with his stunner.
"I'm sorry about this," he whispered softly as he carried her from the bed. "I'm so sorry, but I promise I'll make it up to you."
Anna Miller was Casanova's next great love. Chapter 48 A dizzying medical mystery began the following morning. Everyone at North Carolina University Hospital was baffled, especially me. Kate McTiernan had begun to talk very early that morning. I wasn't there, but apparently Kyle Craig was in her room at daybreak. Unfortunately, our valuable witness was making no sense to anyone. The highly intelligent intern raved incoherently throughout most of the morning. She seemed to be psychotic at times, and almost as if she were speaking in tongues. She experienced tremors, convulsions, and signs of abdominal and muscle cramps, according to the hospital write-up reports. I visited with her late that afternoon. There was still concern that she had suffered brain damage. Most of the time I was in her room, she was quiet and unresponsive. Once, when she tried to speak, only a terrifying scream came out. The doctor in charge came by the room while I was in there. We had already talked a couple of times that day. Dr. Maria Ruoco wasn't interested in withholding important information about her patient from me. She was extremely helpful and nice, in fact. Dr. Ruoko said she wanted to help catch whoever, or whatever, had done this to the young intern. I suspected that Kate McTiernan believed she was still being held captive. As I watched her struggle against unseen forces, I sensed that she was a terrific fighter. I found myself rooting for her in the hospital room. I volunteered to sit with Kate McTiernan for long stretches. Nobody fought me for hospital surveillance duty. Maybe she would say something, though. A phrase, or even a single word, might become an important clue in the hunt for Casanova. All we needed was one clue to mobilize everything. "You're safe now, Kate," I whispered every so often. She didn't seem to hear me, but I kept it up anyway. I got an idea, an irresistible notion, around 9:30 that night. The team of doctors assigned to Kate McTiernan had already left for the day. I needed to tell someone, so I called the FBI and persuaded them to let me call Dr. Maria Ruoko at her home near Raleigh.
"Alex, are you still there at the hospital?" Dr. Ruoko asked when she got on the phone.
She seemed more surprised than angry about the nocturnal call to her house. I had already spoken with her at great length during the day. We had both gone to Johns Hopkins, and we talked a little about our backgrounds. She was very interested in the Sonogy case, and had read my book. I was sitting here obsessing as usual. I was trying to figure out how he kept his victim subdued. I began to tell Maria Ruoko my theory, and what I had already done about it. I figured he might drug them, and maybe he used something sophisticated. I called your lab for the results from Kate McTiernan's toxic screen. They found Marinol in her urine.
Marinol?
Dr. Ruoko sounded surprised, just as I had been at first.
How the hell did he get Marinol to give her? That's a real bolt out of the blue. What a clever idea, though. It's almost brilliant.
Marinol's a good choice if he wanted to keep her submissive. Wouldn't that account for her psychotic episodes today, I said. Tremors, convulsions, hallucinations. The whole package fits, if you think about it.
You could be right, Alex. Marinol, Jesus!
The symptoms of Marinol withdrawal could mimic the most severe DTs. But how would he know so much about Marinol and how to use it? I don't believe a layman would come up with that.
I had been wondering the same thing. Maybe he's been in chemotherapy. He could have been ill with cancer. Perhaps he had to take Marinol.
Maybe he's disfigured in some way.
Maybe he's a doctor or a pharmacist.
Dr. Ruoko offered up another guess. I had thought of those possibilities as well. He could even be a doctor working at University Hospital.
Listen, our favorite intern might be able to tell us something about him that can help us stop him. Can we do anything to get her through this withdrawal a little faster?
I'll be there in about 20 minutes, less than that, Maria Ruoko said. Let's see what we can do to help the poor girl out of her bad dream state. I think we'd both like to talk to Kate McTiernan.
Chapter 49. Half an hour later, Dr. Maria Ruoko was with me in Dr. Kate McTiernan's room. I hadn't told the Durham police or the FBI what I had discovered. I wanted to talk to the intern first. This could be a break in the case, the biggest so far. Maria Ruoko examined her important patient for nearly an hour. She was a no-nonsense but user-friendly doctor. She was very attractive, ash-blonde, probably in her late 30s. A little bit of a southern belle, but pretty terrific anyway. I wondered if Casanova had ever stalked Dr. Ruoko.
"The poor kid is really going through it," she said to me.
"She had nearly enough Marinol in her system to kill her."
"I wonder if that was the original idea," I said. "She might have been one of his rejects."
"Damn it, I want to talk to her."
Kate McTiernan seemed to be asleep, a restless sleep, but sleep. The instant Dr. Ruoko's hands touched her, though, she moaned. Her bruised face twisted into a stark, fearful mask. It was almost as if we were watching her back in captivity. The terror was palpable, scary. Dr. Ruoko was extremely gentle, but the soft moans and groans continued. Then Kate McTiernan finally spoke without opening her eyes.
"Don't touch me! Don't you dare touch me, you fucker!"
she shouted. Her eyes still didn't open. She was squeezing them very tightly, in fact.
"Leave me alone, you son of a bitch!"
"These young doctors," Dr. Ruoko made a joke of it.
She was a cool head under pressure.
Incredibly disrespectful as a group. And the goddamn language.
Watching Kate McTiernan now was like seeing someone being physically tortured. I thought of Naomi again. Was she in North Carolina? Or in California somehow? Was the same thing happening to her? I chased the disturbing image out of my head, one problem at a time. It took another half hour for Dr. Ruoco to treat Kate McTiernan. She put her on an IV dose of Librium. Then she reconnected the heart monitor Kate was on because of her injuries. When she had finished, the intern drifted off into an even deeper sleep. She wasn't going to tell us any of her secrets tonight.
"I like your work," I whispered to Dr. Ruoco. "You did good."
Maria Ruoco motioned for me to step outside with her. The hospital corridor was in semi-darkness. It was very quiet, and as eerie as hospitals can be at night. I had the recurring thought that Casanova could be a doctor at University Hospital. He might even be inside the hospital now, even at this late hour.
"We've done everything we can do for her right now, Alex. Let the Librium do its job. I count 3 FBI agents plus 2 of Durham's finest guarding young Dr. McTiernan from the bogeyman for tonight. Why don't you go back to your hotel? Get some sleep yourself. How about a little Valium for you, kind sir?"
I told Maria Ruoco that I preferred to sleep at the hospital. "I don't think Casanova will come after her here, but there's no way to tell. He just might." Especially if Casanova was a local physician, I was thinking. But I didn't mention that to Maria. Besides, I feel a connection to Kate in there. I have from the first time I saw her. Maybe she knew Naomi. Dr. Maria Ruoco stared up at me. I had at least a foot in height on her. She spoke with a total deadpan look on her face.
"You appear sane. You sound sane at times. But you're certifiable," she said and smiled.
Her bright blue eyes twinkled playfully. "Plus I'm armed and dangerous," I said.
"Good night, Dr. Cross," Maria Ruoco said, and she blew me a feathery kiss.
"Good night, Dr. Ruoco, and thank you."
I sailed a kiss back at her as she walked down the corridor. I slept restlessly on 2 uncomfortable club chairs pulled together inside Kate McTiernan's room. I kept my revolver cradled in my lap. Pleasant dreams, I'm sure.
Chapter 50.
"Who are you? Who the hell are you, mister?"
A loud, high-pitched voice woke me up. It was close by, almost in my face. I remembered immediately that I was at the University of North Carolina Hospital. I remembered exactly where I was in the hospital. I was with Kate McTiernan, our prize witness. "I'm a policeman," I said in a soft and hopefully reassuring voice to the traumatized intern. "My name is Alex Cross. You're in North Carolina University Hospital. Everything is okay now." At first, Kate McTiernan looked as if she might cry. Then she seemed to take hold of herself. Watching her grab control like that helped me understand how she had survived both Casanova and the river. This was a very strong-willed woman I had been watching over.
"I'm in the hospital?"
Her words were slightly slurred, but at least she was coherent.
"Yes, that's right," I said, holding up one hand, palm facing out. "You're safe now. Let me run and get a doctor. Please, I'll be right back."
The slight slurring continued, but Dr. McTiernan was focused, scarily so.
"Hold on a minute. I am a doctor. Let me get my bearings before we invite company in to visit. Just let me collect my thoughts. You're a policeman?"
I nodded. I wanted to make this as easy for her as I possibly could. I wanted to hug her, hold her hand, do something supportive and yet not threatening, after what she'd been through the past few days. I also wanted to ask her about 100 important questions. Kate McTiernan looked away from me.
"I think he drugged me. Or maybe all that was a dream?"
"No, it wasn't a dream. He used a powerful drug called Marinol." I told her what we knew so far. I was being so careful not to push Kate the wrong way.
"I must have been really tripping."
She tried to whistle and made a funny sound. I could see where she was missing a tooth. Her mouth was probably dry, her lips were swollen, especially the upper lip. Odd as it seemed, I found myself smiling.
You were probably on the planet Weirdness for a while. It's nice to have you back.
It's really nice to be back, she said in a whisper.
Tears welled up in her eyes.
Sorry, she said. I tried so hard not to cry in that horrible place. I didn't want him to see any weakness he could exploit. I want to cry now. I think I will.
Oh, please, you just cry your eyes out. I whispered, too. I could barely talk or keep back tears myself. My chest felt tight. I went over to the hospital bed and I lightly held Kate's hand as she wept. You don't sound like you're from the South, Kate McTiernan finally spoke again. She was grabbing control of herself. It amazed me she could do that. I'm from Washington, D.C., actually. My niece disappeared from Duke Law School 10 days ago. That's why I'm down here in North Carolina. I'm a detective. She seemed to see me for the first time. She also appeared to be remembering something important.
There were other women at the house where I was kept prisoner. We weren't supposed to talk. All communication was strictly forbidden by Casanova, but I broke the rules. I talked to a woman named Naomi.
I stopped her, cut her off there. My niece's name is Naomi Cross, I said. She's alive? She's all right? My heart felt as if it were going to implode. Tell me what you remember, Kate. Please. Kate McTiernan grew more intense.
I talked to Naomi. I don't remember her last name. I also talked to Kristen. The drugs. Oh, God, was it your niece? Everything is so hazy and dark right now. I'm sorry.
Kate's voice trailed off as if someone had let the air out of her. I gently squeezed her hand.
No, no. You just gave me more hope than I've had since I came down here.
Kate McTiernan's eyes were fixed and solemn, staring into mine. She seemed to be looking back at something horrifying that she wanted to forget.
I don't remember a lot of it right now. I think Marinol has that side effect. I remember that he was going to give me another injection. I kicked him, hurt him enough to get away. At least, I think that's what happened. There were thick, thick woods. Carolina pines, hanging moss everywhere. I remember, I swear to God, the house, wherever we were being kept, it disappeared. The house where we were being held captive just disappeared on me.
Kate McTiernan slowly shook her head of long brown hair back and forth. Her eyes were wide with astonishment. She seemed amazed at her own story.
That's what I remember. How could that be? How could a house disappear?
I could tell that she was reliving her very recent, terrifying past. I was right there with her. I was the first one to hear the story of her escape, the only one so far to hear our witness speak. Chapter 51 Casanova was still disturbed and highly agitated about the loss of Dr. Kate McTiernan. He was restless and had been wide awake for hours. He rolled over and over in bed. This was no good. This was dangerous. He had made his first mistake. Then someone whispered in the darkness.
Are you all right? Are you okay?
The woman's voice startled him at first. He had been Casanova. Now he seamlessly switched over to his other persona, the good husband. He reached out and gently rubbed his wife's bare shoulder.
I'm okay. No problem. Just a little trouble sleeping tonight.
I noticed. How could I not? The human-Mexican jumping bean strikes again.
There was a smile in her sleepy voice. She was a good person, and she loved him.
Sorry,
Casanova whispered, and kissed his wife's shoulder. He stroked her hair as he thought about Kate McTiernan. Kate had much longer brown hair. He kept stroking his wife's hair, but he drifted back into his own tortured thoughts again. He really didn't have anyone to talk to, did he? Not anymore. Not around here in North Carolina, certainly. Not even in the highfalutin research triangle belt. He finally climbed out of bed and trudged downstairs. He shuffled into his den and quietly shut and locked the door. He looked at his wristwatch. It was 3 a.m. That would make it 12 out in Los Angeles. He made the call. Actually, Casanova did have someone to talk to. One person in the world. "It's me," he said, when he heard the familiar voice on the line. "I'm feeling a little crazy tonight. I thought of you, of course." "Are you implying that I lead a wanton and half-mad life?" the gentleman caller asked with a chuckle. "That goes without saying." Casanova was feeling better already. There was someone he could talk to and share secrets with. "I took another one yesterday. Let me tell you about Anna Miller. She's exquisite, my friend." Chapter 52 Casanova had struck again. Another student, a bright, beautiful woman named Anna Miller, had been abducted from a garden apartment she shared with her lawyer boyfriend near the State University of North Carolina in Raleigh. The boyfriend had been murdered in their bed, which was a new twist for Casanova. He left no note and no other clues at the crime scene. After a mistake, he was showing us he was letter perfect again. I spent several hours with Kate McTiernan at the University of North Carolina Hospital. We got along well. I felt that we were becoming friends. She wanted to help me with the psychological profile on Casanova. She was telling me everything that she knew about Casanova and his women captives. As far as she could tell, there had been 6 women held as hostages, including herself. It was possible that there were more than 6. Casanova was extremely well organized, according to Kate. He was capable of planning weeks and weeks ahead, of studying his prey in amazing detail. He seemed to have built the House of Horrors by himself. He had installed plumbing, a special sound system, and air conditioning, apparently for the comfort of his women captives. Kate had only seen the house in a drug state, though, and she couldn't describe it very well. Casanova could be a control freak who was violently jealous and extremely possessive. He was sexually active and capable of several erections in a night. He was obsessed with sex and the male sexual urge. He could be thoughtful in his way. He could also be romantic, his own word. He loved to cuddle and kiss and talk to the women for hours. He said that he loved them. In midweek, the FBI and the Durham police finally agreed on a secure place in the hospital for Kate McTiernan to meet with the press for the first time. The news conference was held in a wide entrance corridor on her floor. The all-white hallway was jam-packed to the glowing red exit signs with reporters clutching their notepads and TV people with mini-cams hoisted on their shoulders. Policemen with automatic weapons were also present, just in case. Homicide detectives Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes stayed close to Kate during the course of the TV taping. Kate McTiernan was well on her way to becoming a national figure. Now the general public would get to actually meet the woman who had escaped from the House of Horrors. I felt sure that Casanova would be watching, too. I hoped he wasn't right there in the hospital with us. A male nurse, who was clearly a bodybuilder, pushed Kate into the noisy, crowded hallway. The hospital wanted her in a wheelchair. She had on baggy UNC sweatpants and a simple white cotton T-shirt. Her long brown hair was full and shiny. The bruising and swelling around her face was down a lot. "I almost look like my old self," she had told me. "But I don't feel like my old self, Alex. Not inside." When the nurse wheeled the bulky chair almost up to a stand of microphones, Kate surprised everyone. She slowly stood up and walked the rest of the way. "Hello. I'm Kate McTiernan, obviously," she said to the assembled reporters, who now pushed in even closer to the prime witness. "I have a very brief statement to make, then I'll get out of everybody's hair." Her voice was strong and vibrant. She was very much in control of herself, or so it seemed to all of us watching and listening. Her light touch and subtle humor drew smiles and laughter from the crowd. One or two of the reporters tried to ask questions, but the noise level had risen, and it was hard to hear them. Cameras flashed and buzzed up and down the packed hospital corridor. Kate stopped speaking, and it became relatively quiet again. At first, everyone thought the press conference was too much for her to handle. A nearby doctor stepped forward, but she waved him away. "I'm fine. I'm really okay, thanks. If I'm woozy or anything, I'll sit right down in the chair like a model patient. I promise you I will. No false bravado from me." She was definitely in control of this moment. She was older than most medical students or interns, and in fact, she looked like a doctor. She peered around the room. She was curious, it seemed. Maybe a little amazed. Finally, she apologized for the momentary lapse.
I was just gathering my thoughts.
What I would like to do is tell you what I can about what happened to me, and I will tell you everything I can. But that will be it for today. I won't answer any questions from the press. I'd like you all to respect that. Is that a fair deal?
She was poised and impressive in front of the TV cameras. Kate McTiernan was surprisingly relaxed under the circumstances, as if she could have done this for a living. I'd found her to be very self-assured and confident whenever she needed to be. At other times, she could be as vulnerable and afraid as the rest of us.
First, I would like to say something to all the families and friends who have someone missing. Please, don't give up hope. The man known as Casanova strikes only if his explicit commands are disobeyed. I broke his rules, and I was badly beaten, but I did manage to escape. There are other women where I was kept captive. My thoughts are with them in ways you can't imagine. I believe in my heart that they are still alive and safe.
The reporters pressed in closer and closer to Kate McTiernan. Even in her battered condition, she was magnetic. Her strength shone through. The TV cameras liked her. So would the public, I knew. For the next few moments, she did everything she could possibly do to allay the fears of the families of the missing women. She stressed again that she had been hurt only because she broke the house rules set down by Casanova. I thought that maybe she was sending a message to him, too. Blame me, not the other women. As I watched Kate speak, I asked myself some questions. Does he take only extraordinary women? Not just beauties, but women who are special in every way? What did that mean? What was Casanova really up to? What game was he playing? My suspicion was that the killer was obsessed with physical beauty, but that he couldn't bear to be around women who weren't as smart as he was. I sensed that he craved intimacy also. Finally, Kate stopped speaking. Tears were shining in her eyes like perfect glass drops.
"I'm through now," she said in a soft voice. "Thank you for taking this message out to the families of the missing women. I hope that it helped a little bit. Please, no more questions for now. I still can't remember everything that happened to me. I've told you what I can."
At first, there was an unnatural silence. There wasn't a single question. She had been clear about that. Then the reporters and the hospital personnel began to clap. They knew, just as Casanova knew, that Kate McTiernan was an extraordinary woman. I had one fear. Was Casanova there clapping, too? Chapter 53 At 4 a.m., Casanova packed a spanking new green and gray Land's End knapsack with necessary food and supplies. He headed out to his hideaway for a morning of long-awaited pleasures. He actually had a favorite catchphrase for his forbidden games. Kiss the girls. He fantasized about Anna Miller, his newest captive, on the car drive there, and then as he hiked through the thick woods. He visualized over and over what he was going to do to Anna today. He remembered something, a quite wonderful and appropriate line out of F. Scott Fitzgerald. The kiss originated when the first male reptile licked the first female, implying in a complimentary way that she was as succulent as the small reptile he had for dinner the night before. It was all biological, wasn't it? Tick-cock. When he finally arrived at the hideaway, he turned on the Stones' full volume, the incomparable Beggar's Banquet album. He needed to hear loud, antisocial rock music today. Mick Jagger was 50, right? He was only 36 himself. This was his moment. He posed naked in front of a full-length mirror and admired his slender, well-muscled physique. He combed out his hair. Then he slipped into a shimmery, hand-painted silk robe that he'd bought once upon a time in Bangkok. He left it open to expose himself. He selected a different costume mask, a beautiful one from Venice, originally purchased for just such a special occasion. A moment of mystery and love. At last he was ready to see Anna Miller. Anna was so haughty, absolutely untouchable, exquisite physically. He needed to break her quickly. Nothing could match this physical and emotional feeling. Adrenaline pumping, heart beating loudly, total exhilaration in every part of his body. He brought warm milk in a glass pitcher. Also a small wicker basket with a special surprise for Anna. In truth, it was something he'd been planning for Dr. Kate. He'd wanted to share this moment with her. He had put on the loud rock and roll so that Anna would know it was time to get ready. It was a signal. He was certainly ready for her. Pitcher full of warm milk, long rubber tubing with a nozzle. Cuddly present in the wicker basket. Let the games begin. Chapter 54. Casanova couldn't take his eyes off Anna Miller. The air around him seemed to roar. Everything was charged with high expectations. He was feeling more than a little out of control. Not like himself. More like the gentleman caller. He looked down on his art, his creation. He held a thought. Anna has never looked like this for anyone else. Anna lay on the bare wooden floor of the downstairs bedroom. She was naked except for her jewelry, which he wanted her to wear. Her arms were bound with leather behind her back. A comfortable pillow was propped underneath her buttocks. Anna's perfect legs hung from a rope tied to a ceiling beam. This was how he wanted her. This was exactly the way he'd imagined her so many times. "You can do anything that you want to," he thought. And so he did. Most of the warm milk was already inside her. He'd used the rubber hose and nozzle to do that. She reminded him a little of Annette Bening, he was thinking, except that she was his now. She wasn't a flickering image on some Cineplex movie screen. She would help him get over Kate McTiernan, and the sooner the better. Anna wasn't so haughty anymore. She wasn't supremely untouchable, either. He was always curious about how much it took to break someone's will. Not so much, usually. Not in this age of cowards and spoiled brats. "Please, take it away. Don't do this to me. I've been good, haven't I?" Anna pleaded convincingly. She had such a beautiful and interesting face, in happiness and especially in sorrow. Her cheeks rose sharply whenever she spoke. He memorized the look, everything he could about this special moment, details to dream about later on, like the exact tilting angle of her derriere. "It can't harm you, Anna," he told her truthfully. "Its mouth is sewn shut. I sewed it myself. The snake is harmless. I would never hurt you."
"You're sick and vile," Anna suddenly snapped at him. "You're a sadist."
He merely nodded. He had wanted to see the real Anna, and there she was, another snapping dragon. Casanova watched the milk as it slowly dripped from her anus. So did the small black snake. The sweet fragrance of the milk drew it forward across the wooden 2x4s of the bedroom floor. It was quite magnificent to observe. This truly was an image for Beauty and the Beast. The cautiously alert black snake paused, then suddenly jutted its head forward. The head smoothly slid inside Anna Miller. The black snake cleverly gathered itself in folds and slid farther inside. Casanova closely watched Anna's beautiful eyes widen. How many other men had ever seen this, or felt anything like what he was experiencing now? How many of those men were still alive? He had first heard of this sexual practice for enlarging the anus on his trips to Thailand and Cambodia. Now he'd perform the ceremony himself. It made him feel so much better about the loss of Kate, about other losses. That was the exquisite and surprising beauty of the games he chose to play at his hideaway. He loved them. He couldn't possibly stop himself. And neither could anyone else. Not the police, not the FBI, and not Dr. Alex Cross. Chapter 55. Kate still couldn't remember much from the actual day of her escape from hell. She agreed to be hypnotized, at least to let me try, though she thought her natural defenses might be too strong. We decided to do it late at night in the hospital, when she was already tired and might be more susceptible. Hypnotism can be a relatively simple process. First, I asked Kate to close her eyes, then to breathe slowly and evenly. Maybe I would finally meet Casanova tonight. Maybe through Kate's eyes I'd see how he worked.
"In with the good air, out with the bad," Kate said,
keeping her good humor most of the time.
Something like that, right, Dr. Cross?
Clear your mind as much as you can, Kate, I said.
I don't know about the wisdom of that.
She smiled.
There's an awful lot bumping around in there right now. Rather like an old, old attic filled with unopened dresses and portmanteaus.
Her voice was beginning to sound a little sleepy. That was a hopeful sign.
Now just count back slowly from 100. Begin whenever you feel like it, I told her.
She went under easily. That probably meant that she trusted me somewhat. With the trust came responsibility on my part. Kate was vulnerable now. I didn't want to hurt her under any circumstances. For the first few minutes, we talked as we often did when she was fully conscious and awake. We had enjoyed talking to each other from the start.
"Can you remember being kept in the house with Casanova?" I finally asked her a leading question.
"Yes. I remember quite a lot now. I remember the night he came into my apartment. I can see him carrying me through some kind of woods to wherever I was kept. He carried me like my weight was nothing."
"Tell me about the woods you went through, Kate."
This was our first dramatic moment. She was actually with Casanova again, in his power, a captive. I suddenly realized how quiet the hospital was all around us.
"It was too dark, really. The woods were very thick, very creepy. He had a flashlight with him, kept it on a string or rope around his neck. He's unbelievably strong. I thought of him as an animal, physically. He compared himself to Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights. He has a very romantic view of himself and what he's doing. That night, he whispered to me as if we were already lovers. He told me he loved me. He sounded sincere."
"What else do you remember about him, Kate? Anything you recall is helpful. Take your time."
She turned her head as if she were looking at someone off to my right.
"He always wore a different mask. He wore a reconstructive mask one time. That was the scariest one. They're called death masks because hospitals and morgues sometimes use them to help identify accident victims who are unrecognizable."
"That's interesting about the death masks. Please go on, Kate. You're being incredibly helpful."
"I know that they can make them right from a human skull, pretty much any skull. They'll take a photo of it, cover the photo with tracing paper, draw the features. Then they build an actual mask from the drawing. There was a death mask in the movie Gorky Park. They aren't usually meant to be worn. I wondered how he'd gotten it."
"Okay, Kate," I was thinking to myself. "Now keep going about Casanova." "What happened on the day that you escaped?" I asked her, leading her just a little. For the first time, she seemed uncomfortable with the question. Her eyes opened for a split second, as if she were in a light sleep, and I had woken her, jarred her. Her eyes shut again. Her right foot was tapping very rapidly.
"I don't remember very much about that day, Alex. I think I was drugged out of my mind, off the planet."
"That's okay. Anything you remember is very good for me to know. You're doing beautifully. You told me once that you kicked him. Did you kick Casanova?"
"I kicked him, about 3/4 speed. He yelled out in pain and he went down."
There was another long pause. Suddenly, Kate started to cry. Tears welled up in her eyes, and then she was sobbing very, very hard. Her face was wet with perspiration as well. I felt that I should bring her out of the hypnosis. I didn't understand what had just happened, and it scared me a little. I tried to keep my own voice very calm. "What's the matter, Kate? What's wrong? Are you okay?"
"I left those other women there. I couldn't find them at first. Then I was so unbelievably confused. I left the others."
Her eyes opened, and they were filled with fear, but also tears. She had brought herself out. She was strong like that.
"What made me so afraid?" she asked me. "What just happened?"
"I don't know for sure," I told Kate. "We would talk about it later, but not right now." She averted her eyes from mine. It wasn't like her.
"Can I be alone?"
she whispered then.
Can I just be alone now? Thank you.
I left the hospital room feeling almost as if I had betrayed Kate. But I didn't know if there was anything that I could have done differently. This was a multiple homicide investigation. Nothing was working so far. How could that be? Chapter 56. Kate was released from University Hospital later that week. She had asked if we could talk for a while each day. I readily agreed. "This isn't therapy in any way, shape, or form," she told me. She just wanted to vent with somebody about some difficult subjects. Partly because of Naomi, we had formed a quick, strong bond. There was no further information, no more clues about Casanova's link with the gentleman caller in Los Angeles. Beth Lieberman, the reporter at the Los Angeles Times, refused to talk to me. She was peddling her hot literary property in New York. I wanted to fly out to L.A. to see Lieberman, but Kyle Craig asked me not to. He assured me that I knew everything the Times reporter had on the case. I needed to trust someone. I trusted Kyle. On a Monday afternoon, Kate and I went for a walk in the woods surrounding the Waikagil River, where she'd been found by the two boys. It was still unspoken, but we seemed to be in this thing together now. Certainly no one knew more about Casanova than she did. If she could remember anything more, it would be so useful. The smallest detail could be a clue that might open up everything. Kate became quiet and unusually subdued as we entered the dark, brooding woods east of the Waikagil River. The human monster could be lurking out here, maybe prowling in the woods right now. Maybe he was watching us. I used to love walking in woods like these. Blackberry brambles and sweet sassafras. Cardinals and blue jays feeding everywhere. It reminds me of when I was growing up, Kate told me as we walked. My sisters and I used to go swimming every single day in a stream like this one. We swam naked, which was forbidden by my father. Anything my father strictly forbade, we tried to do. All that swimming experience came in handy, I said. Maybe it helped you get safely down the Waikagil. Kate shook her head. No, that was just pure stubbornness. I vowed I wasn't going to die that day. Couldn't give him the satisfaction. I was keeping my own discomfort about being in the woods to myself. Some of my uneasiness had to do with the unfortunate history of these woods and the surrounding farmlands. Tobacco farms had been spotted all through here once upon a time. Slave farms. The blood and bones of my ancestors. The extraordinary kidnapping and subjugation of more than 4 million Africans who were originally brought to America. They had been abducted against their will. I don't remember any of this terrain, Alex, Kate said. I had strapped on a shoulder holster before we left the car. Kate winced and shook her head at the sight of the gun. But she didn't protest beyond the baleful look. She sensed that I was the dragon slayer. She knew there was a real dragon out here. She'd met him. I remember I ran away, escaped into woods just like these, tall Carolina pines. Not much light getting through. Eerie as a bat cave. I remember clearly when the house disappeared on me. I can't remember too much else. I'm blocking it. I don't even know how I got into the river. We were about 2 miles from where we'd left the car. Now we hiked north, staying close to the river Kate had floated down on her miraculous, stubborn escape. Every tree and bush reached out relentlessly toward the diminishing sunlight. "This reminds me of the Baki," Kate said. Her upper lip curled in an ironic smile. "The triumph of dark, chaotic barbarism over civilized human reason." It felt as if we were moving against a high, relentless tide of vegetation. I knew she was trying to talk about Casanova and the terrifying house where he kept the other women. She was trying to understand him better. We both were. "He's refusing to be civilized or repressed," I said. "He does whatever he wants. He's the ultimate pleasure-seeker, I suppose. A hedonist for the times."
"I wish you could hear him talk. He's very bright, Alex."
"So are we," I reminded her. "He'll make a mistake, I promise." I was getting to know Kate very well by now. She was getting to know me. We had talked about my wife, Maria, who was killed in a senseless drive-by shooting in Washington, D.C. I told her about my kids, Jenny and Damon.
She was a good listener. She had excellent bedside manner potential. Dr. Kate was going to be a special kind of doctor. By 3 that afternoon, we must have walked 4 or 5 miles. I felt grungy and a little achy. Kate didn't complain, but she must have been hurting. Thank God the karate kept her in great shape. We hadn't found any sign of where she had run during her escape. None of the landmarks we passed looked familiar to her. There was no disappearing house, no Casanova, no outstanding clues in the deep, dark woods. Nothing to go on. "How the hell did he get so good at this?" I muttered as we tramped back to the car. "Practice," Kate said with a grimace. "Practice, practice, practice." Chapter 57 The two of us stopped to eat at Spanky's on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. We were bushed, famished, and most of all thirsty. Everybody knew Kate at the popular bar and restaurant, and they made a nice fuss over her when we walked in. A muscular, blonde-haired bartender named Hack started a big round of applause. A waitress and friend of Kate's gave us a table of honor at a front window on Franklin Street. The woman was a doctoral candidate in philosophy, Kate told me. Verda, the waitress philosopher of Chapel Hill. "How do you like being a celebrity?" I kidded Kate once we were seated. "Hate it." "Hate it," she said, with her teeth clenched tightly. "Listen, Alex, can we get Blotto drunk tonight?" Kate suddenly asked. "I'd like a tequila, a mug of beer, and some brandy," she told Verda. The waitress philosopher grimaced and wrinkled her nose at the order. "I'll have the same," I said. "When in college, Bill." "This definitely isn't therapy," Kate said to me as soon as Verda departed. "We're just going to bullshit some tonight." "That sounds like therapy," I said to her. "If it is, then we're both on the couch." We talked about a lot of unrelated things for the first hour or so. Cars, rural versus big city hospitals, the UNC-Duke rivalry, Southern Gothic literature, slavery, child-rearing, doctors' salaries in the healthcare crisis, rock and roll lyrics versus blues lyrics, a book we'd both enjoyed called The English Patient. We'd been able to talk to each other right from the beginning. Almost from the first moment at University Hospital, there had been some kind of bright sparks between us. After the first blitzkrieg round of drinks, we settled into slow sipping. Beer in my case, the house wine in Kate's. We got a little buzzed, but nothing too disastrous. Kate was right about one thing. We definitely needed some kind of release from the stress of the Casanova case. Around our third hour in the bar, Kate told a true story about herself that was almost as shocking to me as her abduction. Her brown eyes were wide as she spun her tail. Her eyes sparkled in the bar's low light. "Let me tell you this one time now. Southerners love to tell a story, Alex. We're the last safekeepers of America's sacred oral history." "Tell me the story, Kate." "I love to listen to stories. So much so that I made it my job." Kate put her hand on top of mine. She took a deep breath. Her voice got soft, very quiet. "Once upon a time, there was the McTiernan family of Birch. This was a happy group of campers, Alex. Tight-knit, especially the girls. Suzanne, Marjorie, Kristen, Carol Ann, and Kate. Kristen and I were the youngest Goyles, twins. Then there was Mary, our mother, and Martin, our father. I'm not going to say too much about Martin. My mother made him leave when I was 4. He was very domineering and could be as mean as a stepped-on copperhead sometimes. Hell with him. I'm way past my father by now." Kate went on for a bit, but then she stopped and looked deeply into my eyes. "Did anybody ever tell you what a terrific, terrific listener you are? You make it seem like you're interested in everything I have to say. That makes me want to talk to you. I have never told this whole story to anyone, Alex." "Well, I am interested in what you have to say. It makes me feel good that you're sharing this with me, that you trust me enough." "I trust you. It's not a very happy story, so I must trust you a lot." "I have that sense," I told Kate. It struck me again how very beautiful her face was. Her eyes were very large and lovely. Her lips weren't too full or too thin. I kept being reminded why Casanova had chosen her. "My sisters, my mother, they were so great when I was grown up.
I was their little slave, and I was their pet. There wasn't much money coming into the house, so there was always too much to do. We canned our own veggies, jelly, and fruit. We took in washing and ironing. Did our own carpentry, plumbing, auto repair. We were lucky. We liked one another. We were always laughing and singing the latest hit song off the radio. We read a lot, and we'd talk about everything from abortion rights to recipes. A sense of humor was mandatory in our house. "Don't be so serious," was the famous line there. Finally, Kate told me what had happened to the McTiernan family. Her story, her secret, came out in an agitated burst that darkened her face. Marjorie got sick first. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Marjorie died when she was 26. She already had 3 kids. Then in order, Suzanne, my twin Kristen, and my mother died. All of breast or ovarian cancer. That left Carol Ann, me, and my father. Carol Ann and I joke that we inherited my father's snarling mean streak, so we're destined to die of nasty heart attacks. Kate suddenly swung her head down and to one side. Then she looked back up at me.
I was going to say I don't know why I told you that. But I do know. I like you. I want to be your friend. I want you to be my friend. Is that possible?
I started to say something about how I felt, but Kate stopped me. She put the tips of her fingers on my lips.
Don't be sentimental right now. Don't ask me any more about my sisters right now. Tell me something you don't ever tell other people. Tell me quick now, before you change your mind. Tell me one of your big secrets, Alex.
I didn't think about what I was going to say. I just let it come out. It seemed fair after what Kate had told me. Besides, I wanted to share something with her. I wanted to confide in Kate, at least see if I could. I've been screwed up ever since my wife Maria died, I told Kate McTiernan. One of my secrets, one of the things I kept bottled up inside. I put on clothes every morning, and a sociable face, and my 6 gun some days. But I feel hollow most of the time. I got into a relationship after Maria, and it didn't work out. It failed in a spectacular fashion. Now, I'm not ready to be with anyone again. I don't know if I ever will be. Kate peered into my eyes.
Oh, Alex, you're wrong. You are so ready, she told me without any doubt in her eyes or her voice. Sparks. Friends.
I'd like us to be friends, too. I finally told her. It was something I rarely said, and never this quickly. As I stared across the table at Kate, stared over the glowing wick of a dwindling candle, I was reminded of Casanova again. If nothing else, he was a very good judge of a woman's beauty and character. He was just about perfect. Chapter 58. The harem cautiously shuffled toward a large living area at the end of a winding hallway inside the mysterious, loathsome house. The place had 2 floors. On the lower one, there was only a single room. Upstairs, there were as many as 10. Naomi Cross walked cautiously among the women. They had been told to go to the common room. Since she had been there, the number of captives had ranged from 6 to 8. Sometimes a girl left, or disappeared, but there always seemed to be a new one to take her place. Casanova was waiting for them in the living room. He had on another of his masks. This one was hand-painted with white and bright green streaks. Festive. A party face. He wore a gold silk robe and was naked underneath it. The room was large and tastefully furnished. The floor was covered with an oriental rug. The walls were off-white and freshly painted. Come in, ladies, don't be shy, don't be bashful, he said from the back of the room. He had a stun gun and a pistol, and struck a dashing pose. Naomi imagined that he was smiling behind the mask. More than anything, she wanted to see his face just once, and then obliterate it forever, shatter it into tiny pieces, grind the pieces into nothing. Naomi felt her heart skip as she entered the large, attractive sitting room. Her violin was on a table near Casanova. He had taken her violin and brought it to this awful place.
Casanova was waltzing around the low-ceilinged room, like the host at a sophisticated costume party. He knew how to be classy, even gallant. He carried himself with confidence. He lit a woman's